I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. After a break for summer, this is the 1,489th program and the beginning of another series of shows. I'm coming up to 1,500 shows, and in a few months, 2018 marks the 15th year of the podcast, so you'll allow me a little housekeeping. Lyndon McIntyre is coming up in this show, so stay tuned for that. I've said for at least the last 4 years or so, when the show marked its 10th anniversary, that there are more shows behind me than ahead of me. With each year, the shows, the interviews themselves, my calendar, are all getting more time-consuming to plan, organize, and carry out. I've mulled cutting back, but in the last 2 years, I've seen an increase in the number of shows altogether. I enjoy the work a great deal, but it's time to look into the future a little more carefully and considerately. I intend, barring illness or something sudden, to continue the show into the next year and into the fall of 2018. I feel so close to the 15th anniversary of the show that it would be a little silly to avoid making it to that anniversary. But I will be cutting back this year and be thinking about the sort of programs I want to do from here on in. I do wish to narrow the focus of the sort of topics I talk about. For example, you haven't heard here a day-to-day covering of political issues like the 2015 federal election through to this past spring's provincial election here in British Columbia. That's been deliberate, as there are plenty of other podcasts that do the political coverage much better than I could. And as current events moves at a fast pace, especially in the Trump era, covering world affairs daily is not something that I could do, since I prefer taping interviews in advance. Part of cutting back in at least the last 4 years or so is taping well ahead of schedule, sometimes under embargo. It allows me to have a bit more of a life outside of this show, and it works, and I enjoy it. Not having tape to turn around and post allows me to conduct interviews at a more reasonable pace. For example, today's show with Lyndon McIntyre was taped in mid-August. So I should be here for the next 12 months or so. I will be taking longer breaks in the winter and in the summer and days in between. But I'll be back, and Two Peas in a Podcast with Jackie Pierre will also be back as well in the next few weeks. I'll update on Twitter naturally. On to today's show. Lyndon McIntyre joins me again, the award-winning and best-selling author and acclaimed broadcast journalist, recently published a new novel, The Only Café. A son, Cyril, tries to solve the mystery of the life and death of his father, Pierre Cormier. Mr. McIntyre and I talked about the book, about these characters, the themes of family relations, coincidence, and Lebanon, where Lyndon covered the conflict there in the 1980s. There will be at least a couple of appearances at the Vancouver Writers' Fest later in October. Visit writersfest.bc.ca for tickets and more information. Lyndon McIntyre has been on the program before for his books Why Men Lie in 2012 and 2014's Punishment. He had a distinguished career as a correspondent for CBC's The Fifth Estate, winning many awards for his journalism. In 2009, he won the Giller Prize for his novel The Bishop's Man. This new book is published by Random House. Please welcome back to the Planta Online program, in Toronto this past mid-August, Lyndon McIntyre. Mr. McIntyre, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. So, have you thought about your own funeral?
Well, I'm reaching the age where it's something that one thinks about, but I haven't really got down into the details.
Yeah, like I'm thinking of Churchill, you know, and how he planned it right to the smallest detail, and so the book starts with Pierre Cormier, I guess his son Cyril, learns that his father has died, and they have to he has to start planning his father's funeral, and I'm most fascinated by people who take the time to do that, because I mean I'm thinking to myself, you know, you're dead, what difference does it make how you're memorialized, right?
Well, a lot of people like to have control over these things. I believe there was a hidden motive in how Pierre set up this supposed memorial, which he wanted to take the form of a roast, and he wanted it to happen at a bar, and he wanted it to be set up and presided over by a guy that none of his family knew,
mm-hmm.
a guy named Ari. And I think that you could probably imagine that he had a motive for putting his family in touch with Ari, and especially putting his son Cyril in touch with Ari. And then you have to wonder, well, why would he want this to happen? And I guess it's because he had some sense that if he died anytime soon, that maybe he had a premonition that Ari might have had something to do with his death.
Yeah.
That's the way I would look at it. I mean, on the larger question, I doubt very much. I mean, I know, yes, it's quite common. My mother died recently at the age of 100.
Mm-hmm.
And she made life very easy because she had everything planned down to the final detail. And I don't. This is not an uncommon thing for people to do, people who I don't know, they either want to simplify a complex moment for their survivors, or they're just people who like to control things.
And so what kind of guy is Pierre? He's a journalist, right?
No, Cyril is a journalist, his son. Pierre is a lawyer.
I see.
Pierre is a lawyer who was a refugee from Lebanon in the 80s and left all that behind him and became quite successful. And ended up as a legal vice president for a big mining company. He's a fellow with a lot of darkness in his personal history because he got mixed up in the civil war in Lebanon that ran from 1976 to the 90s.
Uh-huh.
And as a participant in that conflict, he ended up getting involved in a few things that he wasn't very proud of. So he's got secrets. He tries to keep them in the background. He is kind of estranged from his son, and he reinvents himself in many ways. But then in the line of his work as a legal officer for a mining company, he gets dropped into a situation in Indonesia where something happens that brings back a lot of the ugliness from his own personal history. And he decides he has to deal with that somehow.
And so you mentioned that they aren't close, Cyril and Pierre. At the time that the book starts, how long has it been since they've seen each other?
Well, at the time that the book starts, Pierre has been missing for 5 years. So they haven't, for that period of time, they haven't really seen each other. But Pierre has also been out of Cyril's life pretty well for a considerably longer time, because when the marriage broke up, he more or less just moved into another life and left Cyril behind. So it's been quite some time. Cyril is now 24 years old. And the last time he saw his father, he was a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
And but they really didn't have much to do with one another. And so Cyril is now a young man, starting out in as a journalist or as an intern in a broadcast news program. And he sort of develops a natural curiosity about his father, especially now that it has been proven that his father is dead after 5 years of mystery.
Yeah.
It's now proven legally that dad is dead, and the will can now be probated and read, and it has this peculiar instruction in it, which is that instead of a funeral or anything like that, he have a roast.
Yeah.
And this strange instruction puts Cyril in touch with a man that Pierre was involved with in the months before he died, a man that nobody else in the family ever heard of before. So Cyril, as an aspiring reporter, finds himself very curious about this guy, very curious about the fact that his dad was from Lebanon, very curious about the possibility that his dad was involved in the Lebanese Civil War. And he's particularly interested now because in his position in the news media, he's been assigned to research the contemporary problem of homegrown terrorism and radicalization of young people in the Muslim community. So he's curious about that, and as he pursues that, he begins to realize that the problems, you know, of radicalization of young people, of the stresses and the strife in Syria and Iraq, are all part of the same historical context that shaped his father's early life. And the two lives start to come together.
And so I know that you'd spent a lot of time in Lebanon during the Civil War, covering it for the CBC. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. When you sit down to write a book like The Only Cafe, do you think, okay, I really want to deal about this greatly profound moment in my life in this project, in this novel, say?
Not really. The profound moment in my life occurred 35 years ago, and it was a moment that left me with a lot of images and sort of distressing scenes and the rest of it, memories. But eventually they developed into, you know, as I thought them over and I sort of reflected it on them in the context of you know, new conflicts and conflicts that were continuing to happen over there, I sort of started getting certain insights and certain thoughts about just the pervasiveness of violence in the world and the fact that violence is sort of a universal condition, and that a violent act like the one that happens in this novel, which is a true historical act, perpetuates other violence because it disfigures it. It doesn't just kill people. You know, people are killed, they're gone, but the real damage is done in what it does to people who survive, people who witness, people who are affected by it, who are connected one way or another to the people who have been killed. And in the 20th century, according to some research I've seen, there were more than 230 million people who were killed in acts of violence inflicted by other people consciously. And so if you multiply that 230 million by, you know, even a factor of, say, 10, say there were 10 people who were affected by it,
yeah,
by each of one of those acts, you have an astounding number of people who have been left embittered, angry, psychologically and emotionally destabilized, and who are capable of doing things that are reactions to those acts of violence. And so I go back to this moment in my own life where I covered a scene in which a few days before I got there, probably 2,000 people were murdered by a couple of hundred other people.
Mm-hmm.
And this becomes a setting that, for my purposes, will enable me to project an idea, and the idea is that the consequences of violence do not end when the violent act ends. The consequences of violence travel through time and space almost infinitely.
So then why do you think it is, Lyndon, that violence continues? I mean, even if we know that it's bad, why do you think it's still perpetuated in different places around the world throughout history?
Because it alters us. it undermines our reasonable capabilities. Yes, what you say is reasonable and rationally true, but the consequences of violence weaken our reasoning ability. We become emotional in response to violence. You watch, you know, as someone murders a loved one. You watch as someone murders, a neighbor, someone that you know. It affects something deep within you that also affects your reasoning power. The whole concept of retaliation and revenge and anger become factors that are probably more influential in your behavior than the normal kind of clarity with which one reasonably sees stuff. And that's the pernicious nature of violence. It undermines our humanity because our humanity is rooted in our ability to think things through and to reason things out. And the awful wickedness of violence is that it takes some of that away from us, and it causes people to do horrific things.
Yeah, the book also looks at memory, and what I've always been fascinated with is how so many bad things, haunt us. And yet, something happy or even something benign, easily forgotten. Do you have any, after writing a book like this, after the career that you've had in journalism, do you have a sense of why that happens or how that happens in our minds?
Well, I think it's I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist, but I would speculate that we are more affected by bad things because bad things frighten us. If we see a bad thing that happens to someone else, then we have to realize that bad thing can also happen to us. And so we remember it as a kind of a defense mechanism to prepare us to be ready when some bad thing is going on and be ready to avoid having it happen to you. Good things, we enjoy the good things, we enjoy happy moments. I don't particularly believe in happiness as a condition. I believe happiness is episodic. Mm. We have happy moments, we have happy times, and they come and they go and they give us great pleasure. And some of the more extreme, extremely happy moments we do remember. But our more important memories, I suppose, are the memories of events that pose a potential threat to our survival. So if we happen to see someone we know and or care about being killed or injured, seriously injured by another person, it sticks in the mind as being something that could happen to us. And we should not forget that, and we should remember that so that we'll be ready when the danger arises.
Have you got any advice for people who have to deal with trauma and the effects of trauma, not only in their lifetime, but say a previous generation foisted upon them, in terms of how to deal with that so that it doesn't consume them, it doesn't ruin their lives, say?
I believe that, there are therapeutic services available. I think that one has to be conscious of the fact that a traumatic experience has had an impact. You can't just simply say, I got through it and I put it behind me, because the odds are that while you got through it and it is behind you, it has had an effect. Yeah. And one should be very alert to feeling, strong feelings and impulses to behave in a certain way. And if these strong feelings and impulses and behavioral patterns become unusual or even dangerous, then you have to sort of reach out to somebody. The worst thing in the world is just to sort of let it sneak up and take over. I mean, it's very common and tragically common that people who have gone through a great deal of personal trauma will sort of think they're successfully dealing with it by ignoring it, by drinking a lot of booze, by taking pills or what have you, whereas I think the only real way to deal with it is to confront it by talking about it to another person, someone who has the skill to listen to it and to lead your the conversation in a useful direction, as opposed to just sort of listening and reinforcing what you already feel and know. I mean, there are people who are good at this, and there are people who do it. So I think, you know, the advice I would give is don't underestimate the impact that an act of violence or an act of cruelty has had on you, if it has happened to you or if it has happened to someone that matters to you. You have to assume that it has affected you in a way that is not necessarily healthy, and that you should be alert to the symptoms, and you should be alert to changes in your personality and your behavior, and that when you're aware of these changes, you should go and get some help to make sure that they don't get, they don't lead you to a worse place.
And you knew this, or I mean, I should ask you, did you know this throughout your career in journalism? Because you saw horrific things throughout your work, right?
I saw a lot of things that, and it wasn't all blood and mayhem. I saw, you know, I saw great injustices. I saw people in really difficult circumstances because of, through no fault of their own. I've seen people in difficult circumstances because of simple mistakes they made. And I have seen whole societies torn apart by conflict and war and that sort of thing. And I was always affected by it. I suppose, you know, there are people in my line of work in journalism who get off on the adrenaline and the drama mm-hmm. of conflict, and who seek it out. I never really sought it out. I never, and I always sort of came away from it not so much traumatized or shocked or surprised, but I came away from it reminded of the capacity that people have for doing wicked things to other people, and how so often of it is really it boils down to greed. It boils down to a kind of selfish behavior and sentimental reactions to things. And it's very, very, it very rarely has any kind of noble origins. And we have to be on our toes. And, you know, we're living through times right now where the future of the world could be immediately affected by really miserable, small people. Like, you know, Donald Trump, like the leader, the glorious leader of Korea, like people in countries, Turkey and Russia, I mean, Venezuela, miserable people for reasons that are entirely egotistical, twisted, and sentimental and everything else. Are, you know, they're engaged in behavior that immediately has great impact on people's lives and has potentially horrific impact on lives of people far, far away from those places. So, yeah, I mean, the thing is to look at these things, don't get scared, don't get mad, think about them and think about where they could lead and do whatever you can to take care of yourself or to mitigate what these people do.
Now, you told Quill Inquirer a few years ago that you're a student of character, and so as someone who creates characters in works of fiction, as you have in your novels, do you have an idea of what shapes one's character? I mean, especially when we're talking, as we have, about the bad things that people can do. I mean, how do we get there, I guess, is what I'm wondering.
Yeah. Well, I think we inherit certain tendencies. I believe in that. I believe we inherit tendencies based on experiences accumulated by people before us. I also think, though, that the biggest environmental factor in shaping character is just the experience we live through. And it's not just, I mean, you can live through poverty and you can live through anxiety. anxiety and all the rest of it, and come out a better, stronger person. And conversely, you can live through great comfort and wealth and privilege and come out as a lesser human being. And I think that there is something in the way we process experience, sort of a willingness to learn and to improve, to recognize that life is a should be a process of self-improvement. And I think that, that character comes from, or the type of character we develop will come from our willingness to make something worthwhile out of the experience that we live through. If you're lucky enough to be born with the silver spoon in your hand or mouth, to make something worthwhile out of that, don't just presume that you are entitled, and don't just presume that you're better. Just presume you take that as something that offers you opportunities to make something more of yourself. And similarly, if you're born on the wrong side of the tracks, or you're born in really tough circumstances, to try and make the best you can out of the opportunities for self-knowledge and the knowledge of human nature that come from living in difficult circumstances. And rather than becoming angry and jealous and miserable about it, you set a goal for yourself. Look, I'm behind everybody else in terms of my opportunities, but I'm going to friggin' well catch up.
Yeah. Well, what does the Only Cafe say about coincidence? I mean, I was raised a Catholic, and so there's a bit of me that still thinks that there's something beyond just, say, chance and randomness.
Interesting, yeah. One reviewer has made the comment that there's an awful lot of coincidence in the book, but I think life is all about coincidence. Everything, so much of what becomes important in our lives is because of a coincidental moment where you meet somebody or you find yourself standing in the right place or the wrong place, and something happens that is a coincident.
Yeah.
And I believe life is a whole series of either good or a series of coincidences, some of which are good and some of which are bad. And so the only cafe tells us that we can be put in situations where coincidence happens, or we can become subjects of coincidence that was manipulated by somebody else. Pierre ends up in the Only Cafe purely by coincidence. Hmm. And purely by coincidence meets a guy who he believes is part of his dark history, the darker part of the history that he doesn't want to deal with. Now, that is a pure coincidence. He realizes after a little while that this is a coincidence that's probably leading him into a bad place. So then he creates a coincidence in which his son will explore this situation on his behalf. And so it goes. I mean, the coincidence, this book in a way is a product of coincidence. I was sitting in a place called the Only Cafe one evening, and I'm sort of quite preoccupied with the fact that there's a mosque just up the street that I can see, and I can see all these holy religious people heading for prayers. And on another occasion, I'm sitting in the same place, and the bartender comes over. It's a quiet evening. He sits down to chat, and he's an Israeli.
Mm.
And what are you doing? Well, I was just sort of traveling around the world, and I was in Canada. I met a woman, and I married her, and I stayed. And then a little later on, I coincidentally discover, as he's telling me a story about something in his history, that he was an Israeli intelligence officer once upon a time in the Israeli army. I mean, these are factual coincidences, and they got me thinking, what an interesting story if somebody who comes into here out of the blue, bumps into somebody who is a former intelligence officer from Israel and who shares a very dark part of history. And if they have to try to deal with that history in their own way. So in many ways, this book we're talking about was inspired by a series of odd coincidences. A little bar with an interesting name.
Yeah.
I live in the neighborhood. I pop in now and then. I meet a guy who is an Israeli. I'm quite fascinated by the fact that this little bar is in an increasingly Muslim neighborhood with a very, very prominent and busy mosque just along the street a little bit. And these things kind of like crystallize in my mind in the form of a story. Yeah. And so now we're talking about a book.
Yeah. As I was telling you just before we started, I've started it and I'm really enjoying it. I can't wait to see what happens with these people because I sound like I'm patronizing. I mean, you're a pretty good writer, so it draws the reader in very quickly, and it's such a fascinating read, not only about these people that you've created, but I mean some of your own experience too, right?
Yes, and you'll find that. It's an interesting time. I didn't plan it this way, but Cyril's life as an intern and as a temporary, in a temporary position in a newsroom will introduce the reader to an aspect of the news media culture about which people are very confused nowadays with all this attempt to completely discredit the mass media.
Yeah.
As fake, and I think I didn't set out to. I worked in the mass media for 50 years, and I know how it works, and I know the systems, and I know the processes, and I know the interplay among personalities inside of any news organization, and how the product that comes out at the end is not the sort of the whimsy of one individual in the system. It's a collective. Perception. It's a collective effort by a lot of people, a reporter, an editor, a supervisor, a producer, an executive producer, a lawyer. I mean, it's a very complicated process with its own internal dynamic to prevent the dissemination of lies. And when somebody does get a lie out there for whatever reason, It's considered a big and awful event within the media, and it becomes a story in itself. The lie, the fact that the lie got out. So now it's really tragic that on the one hand you have a whole bunch of people attempting to discredit the institution of journalism by deliberately creating and crafting lies and getting them out there, and then having them exposed as lies, and then going the next step and saying the whole institution of journalism is just a process of lying and manipulating, which is in itself a lie.
Yeah. So with everything that's happening in the world today, I mean, did you miss being in journalism?
Well, I've reached the age where I'm better out of it. I think people who are best in journalism are people who have the potential to grow and develop and to come up with new insights and perceptions and ideas for telling stories and finding out information, and I kind of like got past that. Yeah, I'm in my 70s now, and I'm very, very conscious of the fact that there's a whole wave of smart young people who want to be journalism. They want to be in journalism, and they bring more to it in many ways than I brought to it when I was at that age. So many of them speak multiple languages. They know technology. They know the world. The world is a much more familiar place to them than it was to me in the beginning. And so for people like me to be holding down real estate in that profession at this point in time is to, when everything is so tight, it is in many cases to exclude one or two or more of these new people with their new blood and their new ideas. So yeah, I miss the business, I miss the people, I miss the process. But there comes a time when you have to sort of step back from it all, from everything. No matter what you do, you step back at a certain point. And I'm lucky in that along the way I developed an interest in telling stories in long, long form through novels, and that I was able to develop the craft of writing fiction to a point where people will actually publish the books. And this is something that can keep me busy for as long as I want to be busy. And I hope that I will always want to be doing something like this, because I think that idleness, or the form of idleness that shuts your mind off, is it just deprives the whole usefulness of breathing.
Well, long may you continue. I mean, if your mom's any indication, you've got 25, 30 years left, right?
Well, my father died when he was 50, yeah. So who knows what I inherited, although there were extenuating circumstances in his life where he worked very hard in a very difficult line, and he lost, he sacrificed himself to the purpose of making a living, and died as a consequence. And so I hope you're right. I hope that I've got a bit more of my mother's genealogy than my father's.
And long may they there be more books like this.
Well, let's hope. And long may we end up talking about them.
Oh, I hope so. I'm reading another book, All We Leave Behind. I know you know the author quite well.
I know the author quite well.
And I'm looking forward to talking to Carol, I guess, in the next little bit when that comes out.
Yeah, that'll be out in the next month or two. And, you'll have a great chat, because it's a similar kind of a story in the sense that it involves refugees who are trying to reinvent their lives in Canada, and are beginning to, even after a short while, show every likelihood that they will successfully do that.
Yeah, and that book, and of course your book, The Only Cafe, I mean, such timely books too, aren't they?
I hope so.
Yeah.
I hope so. I didn't set out to write a timely book, but luckily it turns out to address a lot of timely themes, and maybe that's the old reporter in me. You tell a story that you tell whether you're conscious of it or not. You tell because it's relevant to the time you're living in. Yeah. And maybe if you're any good at it, you'll tell it in terms that will keep it relevant through time, through history. And so let's hope that it has a useful shelf life.
It's been such a pleasure talking to you again. Congratulations on The Only Cafe, Lyndon, and good luck with it.
Thanks, Joseph. We'll look forward to talking to you the next time.
Indeed.